This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me Mary Ellison. She's the director of policy for the Polaris Project, one of the leaders in the campaign to bring an end to human trafficking and modern-day slavery right here in the United States, if you can believe that. Tell us a little bit, Mary, about how you got involved in this work.
Well, first of all, I got involved when I was in Minnesota. I was asked to do a report on human trafficking in Minnesota, and I really hadn't known much about the issue, but as we got into writing that report, we interviewed about 175 people around the state of Minnesota and really learned about how it was affecting people in Minnesota. And so it really was a chance to see that human trafficking exists not only overseas, which we often hear about, but also here in the United States.
And you don't really think about it in Minnesota or in Wisconsin. I mean, occasionally you hear stories. I remember hearing a story about L.A., you know, some Thai women who were held doing seamstressing, I think, or some light manufacturing many years ago. And then you hear about sex trafficking, too. But it's all over the country, evidently.
That's right. It is. We operate the National Human Trafficking Resource Center hotline, and we get calls from every single state and U.S. territory. We've received over 50,000 calls since December of 2007 and identified over 6,000 potential human trafficking victims here in the United States.
And what is that number?
The number is 888-3737-888.
So that's 888 on either side and then 3737.
That's right.
It's pretty easy to remember. But you're getting 10,000 calls a year. That's a lot of calls. You said you originally were given the assignment to do this paper on human trafficking in Minnesota. How did that happen? I mean, they didn't just pluck you out of the blue.
Well, I was working for a human rights organization called the Advocates for Human Rights, and they were given a grant from the state of Minnesota to really do the report. Minnesota had actually put it into their law that they wanted to do a report on trafficking, and so we were asked to write that report. So I and a few colleagues did the report.
And you have a background in law. You're a lawyer, right?
That's right.
And so some of your work, I gather, has to do with different laws around the states and the federal laws. Now, what is the federal law regarding this?
Well, the preeminent law is the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. It was originally enacted in 2000. And as you may know, or people following this, Senator Paul Wellstone from Minnesota was one of the key champions of the Human Trafficking Act back in 2000. And so it really is the law that sets out the framework. It talks about the fact that we have to prevent human trafficking, we have to protect the victims, and we also have to prosecute the traffickers.
Has there been a lot of prosecution of human traffickers in the United States? I don't read about it very much.
Yeah, there has been some. Certainly we'd like to see more. I mean, if we're identifying 6,000 potential victims on our hotline, we've only seen a few hundred prosecutions. Most of the prosecutions have been done by U.S. attorney's offices around the country. Only about 18 states have actually brought prosecutions against traffickers.
And what are the laws within the states? I mean, they must vary state to state, but are there additional laws that bring additional penalties in some states?
The laws do vary state to state. 49 states now have criminal offenses against human trafficking. There is one state that remains, which is Wyoming. Wisconsin does have laws against human trafficking, both criminal laws as well as a civil remedy, so people can bring a suit against their trafficker. What we don't see very much of in the states is laws to protect victims or to provide assistance, really, the funding for the services that victims need to recover.
I'm speaking with Mary Ellison. She's the director of policy for the Polaris Project, one of the leaders in the campaign to bring an end to human trafficking and what's called modern-day slavery right here in the U.S. Talk to me a little bit about this slavery term. It's not slavery as we remember slavery from the slave trade and from the South here prior to the Civil War. Is it, to what extent is it kosher to call this slavery?
Well, I think there is some disagreement about it, but what we're talking about is the exploitation of human beings. They're exploited in labor, they're exploited in services, and they're exploited in the commercial sex industry. And many times, while there aren't necessarily chains that are binding these individuals, there are other types of chains, psychological chains, physical abuse that's threatened against them, and other chains that keep them in bondage to the traffickers who are holding them against their will.
I know you've called this one of the most pressing human rights issues of our time right here in the United States. And just to explore that slavery issue a little more, I mean, back to the case of those Thai workers, young women in L.A., I mean, they couldn't get out of the building. I mean, they were, they may not have chains around their ankles, but there were chains around the doors. Mm-hmm. And so that seems pretty clear to me. And then the sex trafficking, this is about conscripting young women, often girls even, into the sex trade against their will, right?
That's right. That's right. And oftentimes traffickers use really quite sophisticated methods to entice women and girls into the sex trade. They first tend to, in domestic pimp-controlled trafficking, usually they befriend the young woman or girl and act as if they are the boyfriend or the partner of that individual. They woo them and you know, use every means that anyone would if they're trying to date someone, offering them gifts and so on. And then eventually they do what's called turning them out, and they turn those women and girls out onto the street to then sell their bodies.
And to what extent is organized crime involved, or is this just, you know, one pimp after another doing this in a scattershot way across the country?
Yeah, that's a great question. Essentially, what we've seen is definitely organized crime can be involved. It isn't the case in every single trafficking case. What we see in terms of there's less organized trafficking rings and more organized. And essentially, those more organized ones tend to be associated with organized crime.
And by organized crime, is this, you know, the old Italian mafia in the United States? Is this the Mexican drug cartels? Or what kind of organized crime are we talking about?
Definitely there are gang-related organized crime that occurs. There was a recent case in Virginia, actually, where it was an MS-13 gang that had been trafficking not only, you know, drugs and other things, but had been trafficking women into prostitution as well.
And a lot of the work that you do, Mary Olson, over at the Polaris Project is dealing with the victims themselves. Tell me a little bit about that.
We have been working with trafficking survivors for several years now. We've actually worked with more than 500 trafficking survivors from all over the world. We have, you know, individuals right now who are from Honduras, from Ghana, from Mexico, from the Philippines, and from the United States that we're working with. And essentially what we do is we offer them services to assist them. We connect them with medical resources they might need. We connect them with lawyers if they need a lawyer. We also connect them with each other so that they can have a social support group with others who have experienced something similar. And then we also, of course, provide therapy and counseling because many trafficking victims experience post-traumatic stress disorder, and they essentially present themselves a lot like a torture survivor. And so they do have very, very serious psychological issues that need to be dealt with so they can move on with their lives.
You told me that one kind of therapy that you offer is may not be in the manuals, but is you do a creative writing course with them, and you were trained as a poet. You got your master's evidently in creative writing. How does that work? How does this poetry workshop help people?
Yeah. Well, the idea really is to help trafficking survivors have a voice. Obviously, the traffickers have told them they are worthless, they don't have anything to say, that they are not important in any way. So the idea is to give trafficking survivors a voice. So we meet every couple of weeks, and we read some poetry, we do some writing exercises, and then oftentimes people, if they're comfortable, will share what they've written. And so I've had a chance to hear some really amazing stories from some of the individuals that we work with and, you know, have been struck over and over again by the resilience of the human spirit, even though they've experienced extreme forms of exploitation.
And do they read their poems aloud then, or do they read them in public or just in this little clinic?
So far we have mainly read them just in our clinic, but there have been a few trafficking survivors now who have begun to write and publish their work. There is a trafficking survivor from Minnesota, Christine Stark, who actually has just published a book. And there's also a online site where trafficking survivors are blogging, and I believe it's called Survivors Connect, that you can read trafficking survivors' work. And it's really, I think, a powerful way to get across the message of what they've experienced and try to share that with other people.
Christine Stark, could you tell me a little bit more about her and her story?
Sure. So she's a trafficking survivor, and I believe in her case it was intrafamilial trafficking, which is something that we do see sometimes, where grandparents, grandmothers, aunts, uncles, other people in the family will actually traffic members of their own family. And sometimes that has gone on for generations. And so that is something that I believe was part of Christine Stark's background. And so she has written about that and, you know, trying to get the story out that this is another form of human trafficking that is very much hidden from the view of the public.
Hmm. I mean, you hear a lot about, or I've read a lot about the sex trade coming out of Thailand, where parents would send their young girls out into the sex trade, but I didn't know that was happening here so much. It's kind of horrifying to hear. Is there another individual story that a particular person who sticks in your mind? You don't need the person, use the person's real name if it will release some information that shouldn't be out there in the public, but I'm just trying to give people a sense as to human stories.
Right. Well, one story that sticks in my mind is the story of a woman from Nicaragua, and she essentially was trafficked into a situation where she was working in a household for a family, and she was caring for the children. She was doing all the housework. She was doing all the shopping, and essentially was only allowed to go back and forth, you know, to the grocery store, and that's about it. She wasn't allowed to really go out of the house in any other way, and had to work, you know, 24/7, really low wages, if any, which is a very common situation. This woman ended up going to the grocery store one day, and a mother and a son had just come out into the parking lot, and this woman was in the parking lot, the woman from Nicaragua, and was obviously very distressed. And, you know, this was probably her one chance to escape while she was at the grocery store. And so she approached the mother and son, and she gave them a brochure that is actually published by the Department of State. It's a Know Your Rights brochure. And it had the human trafficking hotline number on it. And essentially, she was speaking Spanish. The mother and the son didn't speak Spanish, but they understood, oh, this woman is in distress. They're handing us this brochure, and so maybe we better call. So they called the human trafficking hotline. We answered the call, and we were able then to send out law enforcement to get to help this woman from Nicaragua, to place her with a service provider who could help her and then open an investigation. So I like this story because really it shows the power of community members to help and to really see human trafficking wherever they are and to call for help.
How did she happen to have that brochure?
She actually got it because in 2008, when we reauthorized the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, we put in a provision that basically said the Department of State has to publish this brochure so that anyone coming to the United States on any kind of visa, employment visa, would receive this brochure with the hotline number on it.
Wow. And this problem of domestic workers, I mean, it's not like the Thai workers in the sweatshop in L.A. with the doors locked. I mean, domestic workers, I read about them being in essentially slavery-like conditions, even if they're, you know, doing domestic work for a U.N. ambassador, for God's sakes. I mean, this is kind of an amazing another side of the story that until recently hadn't gotten enough attention. How many domestic workers are there, and how prevalent is it in that industry?
Yeah. It's a great question. The International Labor Organization has just come out with a worldwide figure on forced labor, and that includes both being forced into the commercial sex industry as well as being forced into labor or services. And they've said that there are about 21 million people around the world that are in forced labor. Now, so part of those would be domestic servitude kind of situations. And what we have seen on the National Human Trafficking Resource Center hotline is that the number one type of labor trafficking calls that we receive is domestic servitude situations, so people working in those households. And we certainly have seen this come up in the Washington, D.C. area, where we've had cases of diplomats that are actually trafficking individuals right there in embassies and those compounds in Washington, D.C.
And sometimes you hear if it's a domestic worker who's not from the United States that the father and the family or the mother, whoever the employer is in the family, will take the person's passport away so that they're really stuck.
That's right. That's a very common technique that traffickers use, is taking documents. And even if they're not a foreign national, oftentimes they'll take the individual's driver's license or state ID or whatever it is, so that person can't identify themselves. And so they can't even go to police because they can't even tell them who I am to prove their identity.
I'm speaking with Mary Ellison. She's the director of policy for the Polaris Project, which is working real hard on this issue of human trafficking and runs the National Human Trafficking Resource Center hotline. The number is 1-888-3737-888. So that's easy to remember. It's 888 on either side and 3737 in the middle. What's the next most common call you get other than domestic workers being abused?
Right. Well, we do also get a lot of calls about domestic pimp-controlled trafficking. And what I mean by that is it's happening here in the United States. A lot of times it is involving U.S. citizens that are being trafficked into that kind of a situation where there's a pimp putting women out on the street in a street prostitution situation.
Let's talk about prostitution for a second. Are you or is your organization opposed to prostitution or opposed to the legalization of prostitution? What should we do about this trade, ancient trade?
Right. Well, Polaris Project really takes an abolitionist stance in that we think that prostitution creates the fertile ground for human trafficking to exist. And so we believe that we should do everything that we can to try to shrink that, because that will also help to shrink sex trafficking that's going on in the United States. When it comes to dealing with individuals who have suffered from being in a situation of prostitution, whether it is forced or whether it is voluntary, we do believe that all individuals, whether they're prostituted or whether they're trafficked, should be treated with respect and with dignity. And if they, there are many groups around the country that are helping women exit the prostitution industry. And so we do believe that that should be offered to people, and they should have the ability to access services if they need them.
So you and your organization would be for banning prostitution in Nevada, for instance?
We really try to focus all of our efforts on sex trafficking. We don't work very much on changing prostitution laws. What we do is that when it comes to human trafficking, there is actually, you know, three main parties involved. There's the pimp or the trafficker, there's the person that's purchasing commercial sex, and there's the woman or girl who's either being forced to sell sex or maybe voluntarily involved, although we do think that the number of women voluntarily involved in that prostitution is relatively small. So essentially what we try to do is we try to attack definitely the laws that would hold the trafficker accountable. We try to protect the women and the girls. We've been working actually with a number of different groups around the country to enable sex trafficking victims to try to clear their criminal records, because of course a lot of sex trafficking victims have prostitution convictions. So we've been working on those laws. And then finally, we have been also working on ensuring that the penalties for purchasing sex, especially when you're purchasing sex from a sex trafficked person, are severe enough to deter that behavior.
I'm speaking with Mary Ellison of the Polaris Project. Another thing your organization does, you've mentioned to me, is that you do training not just for the victims and not just in this poetry writing class that you put on, and also the psychological care that they get, and I'm sure other services that your organization provides them, but you also do training with law enforcement. Tell me about that.
Right. Well, obviously, law enforcement are oftentimes the first responders to human trafficking. They're the ones that are encountering victims, whether they know it or not. So one of the things that we try to do is ensure that law enforcement really knows how to identify trafficking victims and look for the various signs. You know, is this person working against their will? Is this person being controlled by someone else and isn't able to exercise their own free will? So we look for that, and we try to train law enforcement to do that as well, because really this is a relatively new sort of, at least even though human trafficking has been going on for centuries, at the same time, I think people don't expect to see it now. And so we have to train people to just put on a lens that helps them to see it. And that's what we do with law enforcement.
But so what are those signs? I mean, how can you tell if someone's being forced to, be a domestic worker against her will?
Right.
If you're not invited into the home, or you don't see them at the grocery store.
Right. Right. Yeah, it is. It's definitely tough. It's tough to recognize trafficking victims. But at the same time, you know, some things to look for include, you know, obviously if there's someone else that is controlling them, oftentimes like in a sex trafficking situation, the pimp or the trafficker will be standing nearby watching that individual, controlling their every move. If that person makes a move that the trafficker, the pimp, doesn't like, he'll swoop in and basically punish that person. And you can even see this happening. We did a video a few years back on this phenomena, and we could see it right by filming it right on the streets that was happening. In addition, in a labor trafficking situation, what you'll often see, let's take a person who's trafficked into the restaurant industry. They may be working in the kitchen, in the back. They're never allowed to interact with the public, so they're socially isolated from other people so that they can't possibly report it. So that's a factor to look for. Isolation, being controlled by another person. Sometimes people will have visible signs of bruises and injuries. Oftentimes that person will not be paid what they should be paid. Also, if their documents are taken, that's another sign. And so there are various things to watch for. The other thing is that in many ways, a trafficking victim will be very shy and somewhat diminutive and deferring to people because they are so afraid. So if you sense that just fear that is in that person, that is another thing that can be a sign. So it's all those things taken together.
And people, if they want more information, can call the National Human Trafficking Resource Hotline that you put out that number again. And I'll give it once more or twice more before we're done. It's 1-888-3737-888. Now, you mentioned restaurant workers or kitchen workers in restaurants. How common is that? I know it is very common to have workers in restaurants who are here in an undocumented way, but to what extent is there real coercion going on there?
Right. That's really we see that it's a pretty frequent. In terms of labor trafficking, the industries that we tend to see trafficking victims are in, I mentioned domestic servitude already, definitely the hotel and restaurant industry, also in construction, in agriculture, in factories. Those are some of the common venues for human trafficking into the labor sector.
Now, nationally, we have this Trafficking Victims Protection Act, which you mentioned at the top, Mary Ellison. It's it came on the books in the year 2000. You mentioned that Paul Wellstone, one of my heroes, was actively involved in getting that piece of legislation passed. But I understand that that piece of legislation expired almost a year ago. What does that mean, and how urgent is it that we get that act enacted?
It's
renewed, or whatever the proper word is.
Yeah, it's extremely urgent. We depend on the Trafficking Victims Protection Act in a number of ways. First of all, we depend on it to provide the funding that's needed to serve trafficking victims. It also provides funding for law enforcement and prosecutors to prosecute the traffickers. It provides funding to prevent human trafficking. It also provides resources that the United States provides actually to other countries to help combat human trafficking around the world, because we know this isn't just a problem that's happening in the United States. It's happening around the globe, and the networks are interconnected, and so we have to address it in that fashion. So we need to reauthorize the Trafficking Victims Protection Act really to provide those three things.
And what's been stalling it? I mean, it's hard for me to believe that, you know, you can't get bipartisan support for a piece of legislation that wants to get rid of human labor and sex trafficking.
Right. Well, we have been having trouble getting it reauthorized. The bills were initially introduced last summer in June and in August in the Senate and then the House. We did have some hearings in the fall on both sides, both the House and the Senate. We did have the bill did pass out of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and we haven't yet had much movement on the House side. There have been a number of things that have been really holding up the act, but right now what we're doing is we're trying to reach the magical number of 60 on the Senate side, and we're getting close. We're close to 50 now, and we're working to get the bill moved through the Senate and then to hopefully advance the House bill as well and bring them into conference committee and get them passed.
I mean, is this a partisan issue where Republicans just don't want to sign on to it? What's going on?
Well, you know, what has really happened is that, you know, there was a controversy around the Department of Health and Human Services is one of the largest grantees of funding for trafficking programs. And the Department of Justice is the other big funder in terms of providing funding for both services and for investigations. So what happened was that there were some questions around the way that the Department of Health and Human Services grants were administered and decisions that were made about who to give those grants to administer. And so controversies arose around that.
We only have about a minute left. I wanted to give you an opportunity, Mary Ellison of the Polaris Project, to tell the person who's listening to this in her car or in his kitchen or at the workplace how that person might be able to help your organization and your cause.
Sure. Well, the first thing that they should do is memorize the Human Trafficking Resource Center hotline number. Program it into your phone, and that number I'm sure will be available on the website. It's definitely available on our website, polarisproject.org. The next thing that people should do is sign up for our grassroots network. We are communicating with people all across the country, and you can sign up and you can receive email action alerts about legislation. You can receive our newsletter so that you continue to learn more about human trafficking. And then the third thing I would say is keep your eyes, keep your ears open, and look for people in your community who may have been exploited and trafficked and lend a helping hand.
So the number again is 1-888-3737-888. And the website is at polarisproject.org.
Yes.
Mary Ellison, thanks so much for being my guest here at Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.